Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, two recent stories that are hard to miss, but about which some might say most media are missing the point. First, an anti-abortion group is releasing sting videos claiming to show that Planned Parenthood profits from the sale of fetal body parts. But rather than focus on sorting facts from flame fanning, media are spending time scoring the grandstanding match among Republican politicians. Jody Jacobson of RH Reality Check will join us to talk about who might be profiting most from this story. Also on the show, the killing of the popular African lion known as Cecil by a bounty hunter led some into an unhelpful parlor game of lions versus people. Which do you care about? Journalists could move the conversation off that dime with a thoughtful examination of the state of animal preservation and the impact of extinction on us all. What might that look like? Well, we'll hear from journalist John R. Platt, who writes about extinction as well as other environmental issues for Scientific American, among other outlets. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. Stories about cyber espionage are weird. For one thing, they include things like quotes that we need to be a bit more public about our responses to cyber attacks like that believed but not officially stated to have been carried out by China against the U.S. Office of Personnel Management. Those quotes delivered from White House officials who speak on condition of anonymity. Well, that's from a July 31st piece by the New York Times' David Sanger, which Marcy Wheeler of the blog Empty Wheel pointed out had a certain fiction mixed in with its reporting. Sanger wrote that the U.S. administration concluded that China's hacking attack was so vast in scope and ambition that the usual practices for dealing with traditional espionage cases did not apply. He called it espionage on a scale that no one imagined before. But how can that be? China is accused of obtaining the personal information of about 20 million Americans, federal employees and contractors, and that's a big deal. But the U.S.'s NSA, according to documents leaked by Edward Snowden, processes 20 billion phone calls and internet messages every day. Their unofficial motto for years has been collect it all. The article notes that the U.S. has its own intelligence operations inside China, but it pretends these are purely defensive, referring to, quote, the placement of thousands of implants in Chinese computer networks to warn of impending attacks, close quote. Well, Sanger knows full well that the U.S. is trying to gather all the information it can from China. He was one of the main journalists covering the U.S.-Israeli cyber attack against Iran, known as Stuxnet. One of his stories went out under the headline, Obama ordered wave of cyber attacks against Iran. But here, in this context, Sanger writes, quote, the United States has been cautious about using cyber weapons or even discussing it, close quote. No, they discuss them plenty and use them too. Some media have just decided that the public should only sometimes hear about it. The Huffington Post's Michael Calderone wrote a piece on the ethical dilemma posed for the weekly New York Observer by the fact that its owner-publisher, Jared Kushner, is married to Ivanka Trump, daughter of real estate mogul and Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. The paper's self-proclaimed mission is to cover, quote, the city's influencers in politics, culture, luxury, and real estate who collectively make New York City unique, close quote. But they've had next to nothing to say about Trump's controversy-fueled presidential bid. Calderone quotes from a memo sent by Observer editor Ken Kersen, quote, if we run something pro-Trump, we will automatically be accused of carrying water for him on account of the relationship to our publisher. If we run something anti-Trump, we will be accused of trying to curry favor with our peers in journalism or worse, intentionally being only a little hard on him so that later we can love him up and point to the earlier softball as proof that we're fair, close quote. Kersen underscored the point to an International Business Times reporter, we are limiting our coverage because the perception of a conflict is unavoidable. So you get it. The Observer is super sensitive about conflict of interest when it comes to its publisher's wife's relatives. Well, that makes it all the more striking that the Observer editor shows no such concern when it comes to his publisher's real estate. Take the Observer's July 14th editorial, Take Back Tompkins Square Park and New York City, which complains about homeless people sleeping in a corner of the park in Manhattan's East Village. And, full disclosure, around the corner from my apartment, as an unmistakable sign that New York City is creeping toward the bad old days. The park's restoration over the last 20 years, the editorial says, quote, has heralded an era where residents and a vibrant collection of small businesses near the park, is there a single better food in all of New York City than the jalapeno cheddar cream cheese at Tompkins Square Bagels, have thrived. Let's not allow that progress to slip through our fingers, close quote. Noting that the city's police commissioner has been to the park, the Observer warned, it will take more than a visit. And shortly thereafter, Tompkins Square got more. It got a guard tower, a high-visibility police command post to address safety issues, according to the mayor's office. That was removed a week later in the wake of passionate dislike expressed by area residents. But what the Observer didn't say in its call for a police crackdown on homelessness in Tompkins Square was that its publisher has a direct financial stake. Jared Kushner's real estate company, Kushner Companies, has been buying up hundreds of rental units in the East Village, including immediately surrounding Tompkins Square. They've been accused of forcing out longstanding residents to convert buildings to luxury units. Kushner even owns the building housing Tompkins Square Bagels, the business that got the personal plug. But editor Kersen, so twisted up about covering Donald Trump, didn't think any of that worth disclosing. And finally, it's true also that few believe that the trauma, illness, and hardship confronted by people who are homeless is best addressed by police. On March 1st, Los Angeles police officers confronted and killed an unarmed homeless black man named Charlie Kanaan on L.A. Skid Row. Captured on cell phone video, the killing received attention because we're living in a moment when many people have decided that the state-sanctioned killing of black people by law enforcement is worth our attention. And that's very uncomfortable for those who would like to believe that every police killing must be in some way justified, if we could only see how. So the autopsy of Charlie Kanaan 5 months later was likely to make some kind of news, but what kind? The Los Angeles Times headline on the autopsy report, July 29th, Skid Row Shooting. Autopsy shows man shot 6 times, had meth in system. And indeed, the story by Kate Mather, while it notes that the autopsy doesn't actually show how drugs might have affected Kanaan's behavior, nevertheless elaborates with comments from a pathologist from San Francisco the possible effects of methamphetamine, and even talks about marijuana exposure because the victim may have smoked it within days of his death. A quote from LAPD Chief Charlie Beck underlines the drug angle. Quote, the combination of mental illness and drug abuse on Skid Row leads to multiple violent confrontations, close quote. Well, GQ's Jeff Charlotte reported on Charlie Kanaan's killing and on the autopsy. His headline, an L.A. cop pressed his gun into the chest of an unarmed man and shot him through the heart. Noting the L.A. Times emphasis, Charlotte writes, quote, in a media narrative now familiar from responses to the police killings of Michael Brown to Freddie Gray, the L.A. Times devotes more ink to the effects of small amounts of meth and marijuana than to the effects of a police officer pressing his gun directly into Charlie's chest and pulling the trigger. Weed isn't news. On Skid Row, meth isn't news. The news from the inquest is that of the gun against the flesh. Close quote. But then that depends on whether a journalist is interested in seeing a problem or unseeing one. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. When an anti-abortion group calling itself the Center for Medical Progress released a secretly recorded video purporting to show a representative of Planned Parenthood discussing making money from the sale of fetal tissue, some saw a hardly veiled effort to damage the Women's Health Organization and the broader cause of women's reproductive health and autonomy by blowing smoke, suggesting some sort of criminal enterprise. But big media, while editorially supportive of abortion rights along with the majority of the U.S. public, are in election mode. And Republican presidential candidates are making hay with the video. And so what could have been a day's story about an amateur stunt designed to further a well-known argument continues to make headlines. Here to help us see what's going on is Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief at RH Reality Check. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jody Jacobson.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be joining you.
Well, for some, of course, any opportunity to say that abortion is ghoulish and horrific is a good one. And we've seen a great deal of lingering over details about fetal body parts that's clearly just meant to provoke disgust about abortion per se. But the pretense here, the reason that it's supposedly news, is that this isn't about the fact that abortions happen. It's the supposed uncovering of Planned Parenthood's venality, because they're actually making money from abortions. So maybe it's not really women's rights that they care most about, I suppose we're meant to think. So what, for the record, for those who've avoided the story, what does Planned Parenthood do and not do with regard to fetal tissue?
Well, first, I want to underscore what you just said, which is that, you know, this really is about taking away the access to safe abortion services that we take for granted. What has been done here is to use a normal research practice and make it seem ghoulish. Planned Parenthood obviously offers abortion. Women go to Planned Parenthood because they're known as a trusted caregiver. Some of those women decide that they want to donate the fetal tissue that results from their abortion to science. And Planned Parenthood facilitates the transfer of that fetal tissue to researchers. By law, they are allowed to recover the cost of storing, shipping, and taking care of the tissue. And that's what they do. There's no profit involved. There's never been any evidence of a profit involved. And what this group has done using altered, falsified videos is to try to imply that somehow Planned Parenthood is engaged in making a profit from fetal tissue.
Well, so if the question is, does Planned Parenthood sell fetal body parts? The answer really is no. And there have been, and I've seen media fact checks that say that, essentially. Even if it sounds like so much sound and fury to some of us, this kind of noise-making and distraction does have a real impact in terms of actual threats on abortion providers and making it more difficult for women for whom access to reproductive health care is already difficult, making it more difficult. So it sounds as though it's kind of, you know, smoke and mirrors, but it can have a real effect in the world.
Absolutely has a real effect. I mean, now we're going to spend untold amounts of taxpayer dollars on fake investigations at the federal level into Planned Parenthood. Then we're going to spend untold thousands or millions of dollars at the state level in Texas and Ohio and all these other places, Louisiana, to investigate Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood is the most investigated organization probably in the history of the United States, with the fewest ever, in fact, no productive investigations. In other words, no investigation has ever found any wrongdoing. And yet, the so-called fiscal conservatives continue to spend your, mine, and everybody else's money investigating Planned Parenthood.
Well, and if this purported show of concern for human life should lead directly to threats against the lives of doctors, not to mention women, that's really not such a hysterical leap to make. I mean, the original founder of the Center for Medical Progress, the group behind these videos, is Troy Newman. And what might listeners know about Troy Newman?
Troy Newman is leader of Operation Rescue, and Operation Rescue has been connected to murders of doctors, or has literally directly and indirectly supported the murders of doctors. For example, Cheryl Sullinger, who is employee of Operation Rescue and is on the board of the Center for Medical Progress, her phone number was found on the dashboard of the car of the murderer of Dr. Tiller in Kansas. This murderer murdered Dr. Tiller, literally assassinated him in the vestibule of his church. In other cases, Troy Newman has made it clear that he thinks it's a justifiable homicide if you kill a doctor who provides abortion.
Well, finally, I know that you can't blame media for everything, but I do feel that as long as reporters feel that they have to report every politician's claims basically credulously, you know, to give weight and attention to baseless assertions because they were in fact made by a person
right.
who's running for office, then there's always a benefit to saying the most inflammatory,
outrageous,
distorted thing, because even if it's criticized, the journalist rule still requires going back to that person to credulously entertain whatever cockamamie thing they say next. You know,
right.
And it's
look at Donald Trump. That's the sort of ultimate example.
Exactly. Well, I know you're at a journalism conference right now. What would you like to see more or less of in terms of media coverage here, or what could journalists be doing to help us cut through this story?
Well, I would really like to see journalists stop reporting as basic fact things that are said by these groups without immediately investigating what exactly has happened. I mean, it didn't need to wait several days for Media Matters, for example, to understand that those videos were doctored. Any journalist should have looked at those videos, looked at the complete video before they reported on the short version, and seen that they were doctored. That's good journalism. Reporting false assertions as though they were facts and later on another page inside the paper making a correction is not good journalism.
We've been speaking with Jody Jacobson from RH Reality Check. You can find them online at rhrealitycheck.org. Jody Jacobson, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
For some, it was the gleeful gratuitousness of the killing by bounty-hunting dentist Walter Palmer of the popular Zimbabwe lion known as Cecil that spurred outrage. For some, the gruesome methods employed, and some, of course, object to the purposeful killing of animals, full stop. But what's the import of this sort of hunting in the context of species extinction? And how could media help us understand issues of extinction in general? John R. Platt is a freelance journalist who covers endangered species and other environmental issues for Scientific American, Take Part, Vice, and other publications. He joins us now by phone from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to Counterspin, John Platt.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we talk about media coverage, can you give us some information on the current status of African lions? How are they doing?
Well, they're not doing great. And part of it depends on what country you're talking about, because Africa is a pretty huge place.
Right.
But in general, African lion populations are down 42% in the last 21 years. And even that number alone, which is pretty shocking, doesn't tell the full story. If you look at West Africa, lions are almost completely gone. They've pretty much been wiped out from most of their range in West Africa. Within the rest of Africa, you've probably got 8 to 10 strongholds where they're actually doing okay. Most of their other populations are really small. They're really spread out. There's no opportunities for genetic partners to move from one population to another to keep things growing. And lions need a lot of space. And there's a lot of things driving that decline. Hunting is obviously one of them. But really the biggest problems are habitat loss and a tremendous hunting pressure on the animals that lions eat. There's so little left for them to eat in a lot of places that they don't have much of an opportunity to thrive.
Right. So it's really a question of something bigger than just one individual species. It's all, things are all connected. Well, I mean, in this context, we have restaurants in the U.S. selling lion meat tacos. Now, I know those aren't African lions, but is there a relationship between something like that and conservation efforts? It's kind of a mixed message, I would think.
Well, it absolutely is. You know, we've got a weird situation here in the U.S. where there are thousands and thousands of big cats, lions, tigers, cougars, leopards, in American backyards, in zoos, in private collections, and that's how things end up in, you know, these lion meat tacos. It's pretty rare. Some of this meat might have been imported into the U.S. because the lions are not currently protected under the Endangered Species Act, which allows some flexibility, if you want to put it that way, for people to import lion products. So when you have a species that is protected in some ways but not in others, it sends a mixed message. And you see that a lot with elephants. Until actually a couple of weeks ago, a lot of ivory was legal, even though most of it was not. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service just proposed new rules that will really tighten that to the point where it's going to be very hard for U.S. consumers, who are big buyers of ivory, to continue to import this stuff when elephants are facing a major poaching crisis in Africa.
Well, social media around Cecil's killing was kind of equal parts outrage over the lion's killing and then outrage over the outrage in an understandable but still disheartening debate about the most acceptable ways to portion out our empathy for living creatures. But it's familiar in media to see species protection presented as, to put it crudely, a sort of either or a zero-sum equation, which leads to the kind of story that I think of as pro and con and done, you know. You're for protecting lions and species and habitats, or you think that's not the priority. I mean, it is a story about choices, of course, but is there a less stagnant framework that we could be using to talk about these things?
Sure. Well, I mean, you see this all the time in the media, whether it's lions or whether it's, oh, this highway project has been stopped because of a little tiny lizard or something like that. Right. And there's a lot of nuance that's missed when you talk about things like that. You can look at a lot of projects out there. Born Free USA has a project in Africa where they build lion-proof bomas for farmers. So every night they can bring their livestock into these lion-proof enclosures. Couple thousand dollars saves them the risk of having their livestock predated upon. And those are the people who often take retaliatory strikes against lions and kill them in the wild. So you can do things to help people coexist. And I think that's an important piece of the message that's often lost. What are the projects being done that can help people and wildlife to live together, if not in Lion King harmony, at least in a way where we have a relationship where we both can thrive?
It seems like some of the change that's needed if we favor species and habitat protection is cultural. You know, no one wants to say, stop using that product or that food that you've been using for centuries, or stop caring about your livestock, for example. But it seems as though legal remedies, which might be the other thing, seem to have their limit, you know, and in that regard, I wonder, you touched on it earlier, but has the Endangered Species Act had the kind of muscle and been used in the kind of way that would make it very useful?
I think the Endangered Species Act is a very good tool. Mm-hmm. Some of its critics will point to the fact, well, very few species have come off the list because they've recovered. And that list is maybe 20 species, something along those lines. And yes, that's very low, but if you look at the number of species that have slowed or stopped their decline since they were protected, that's the huge majority of species that are listed under the Endangered Species Act. On the other hand, there is a huge waiting list of hundreds and hundreds of species that have been proposed for protection, including the African lion, that do not yet have that full protection. And there's only so much the Fish and Wildlife Service can do. They only have so much resources in order to go through this huge backlog of applications to protect these species. But in general, yes, there are loopholes. The Act protects against interstate traffic, but if I'm here in Oregon and someone three blocks over wants to sell me an ivory tusk, I might be able to get away with doing that.
Right. Well, you have a blog feature called Extinction Countdown. It doesn't sound very upbeat, but it's not all negative news. I mean, I do think that part of the reason that people kind of disengage from environmental issues, broadly speaking, is it seems like it's a one-way road towards badness, you know, and and when you look at it more carefully, you see more nuance, more different kinds of stories. What are some of the things that you're reporting on or following now? I don't mean Pollyanna news, but just to show the complexity of the issue.
You know, what I always like to look at are the scientists and conservationists who are trying to learn things, trying to figure out what tools, what science is necessary to protect species, what they've learned, and what steps are being taken. Mm-hmm. Efforts to preserve the largest bumblebee in the world, which was down in Patagonia. You know, you see efforts that are going on. People always talk about the polar bear, but the polar bear's in the news. You know, so every bit of information we get on that is good. I just wrote about a species in Africa, the giant squeaker frog, which had only been seen a couple of times before, maybe 15 frogs in the history that have ever been seen, but they just found 15 more. So this is a species that now we know where it lives, has a chance at survival. As bleak as the northern white rhino is, there's only 4 left in the world. There's a lot of people working to try maybe to get them to breed or at least save their genetic material. So maybe there's a chance of bringing them back. Tigers are bleak, but we're learning more and more about where they are, what habitat they use every day. So there's a lot of really good things out there. And you just have to look for them as a journalist to balance out that bleak, bleak, bleak outlook.
You talked about models where there are communities where they're finding ways forward that can protect both people's interests and those of the animal species, and it seems like a role for reporters would be highlighting those models as well in case they can be replicated.
Absolutely true. And, you know, they're harder stories to find, and a lot of them are focused on a specific ecosystem, so can you take those lessons to another one? It's hard to say. But those are the great stories out there. And I think that if the media focuses too much on the if it bleeds, it leads angle, you miss out on the solutions, on the encouraging aspects of conservation that help people to move forward and say, okay, we can make a difference.
We've been speaking with journalist John R. Platt. You can find his Extinction Countdown on Scientific American's blog at scientificamerican.com. John Platt, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin each week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by the wonderful Kelly Spivey. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.